Welcome to the Frictionless Innkeeper podcast series. Our show is brought to you by the Frictionless Guest app, which allows innkeepers to provide guests with their recommendations of the best places to eat, play, and shop during their stay. The Frictionless Guest app is accessible through all mobile and desktop devices, and you can learn more about it by visiting frictionlessguest.com. Once again, that's frictionlessguest.com. I'm Matt Langan, and I'll be joined by Steve Short, the founder and CEO of the Frictionless Guest app. And our guest for this episode is Linda Smith, the owner and operator of Rachel's Dowry Bed and Breakfast, which is a historic six-room property located in Baltimore. Linda is a former telecommunications executive who purchased the property in 2016, and she will be sharing her innkeeper story along with her OTA strategy and will provide insights into the new legislation happening in Baltimore with regards to Airbnb. And Linda and Steve, how are you both doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. Steve, how you doing?
Doing well, man.
Awesome.
I'm doing well.
Always great to hear your voice. Good. Let's kick it off. So Linda, let's start at the top. If you don't mind, tell us a little bit more about your background and how you came to be an innkeeper in Baltimore.
Sure. Love to. I began my career actually in high-tech marketing. After my master's program in international business, I joined Motorola and was with them for the good first half of my career. And when they were moving me to corporate headquarters, I had the opportunity to instead head to Christchurch, New Zealand to be chief marketing officer for a competitor of Motorola's down there. So after 13 years in New Zealand, I knew it was time for a change. And based on my parents and watching them, I decided it was probably time to be a little bit closer to home. So I came back to the U.S. in late 2015 and began looking for a business to purchase. And initially, I assumed it was going to be a manufacturing business that I would take to another level. However, there were a lot of businesses that came out of 2008 and 2009 in not very good shape. Kind of the things I was looking at really didn't have a whole lot of potential. And then one day, serendipitously, I got into a conversation with my family about bed and breakfast. And we all kind of decided it would be an awesome thing for me to do because I'm bridging the gap to retirement. And I added B&Bs to the list and then took close to a year trying to find the right business, you know, and the B&B is a business as well. So it had to meet all the business criteria. And I came across this place in summer of 2016, and I decided I could call this home. So I purchased it and I took over October of 2016. So here I am.
That's great. That's great. If you don't mind, tell us a little bit more about the property. It's certainly, you know, a historic property right in the heart of Baltimore, and would love to hear more about that.
Okay. I really consider myself very lucky to have this place. It is a 1798 manor home. We think it might be a little older, but 1798 is all we can prove. But the Warner family owned this. They were brickmakers and lawyers. And we were, at the time, we were on the outskirts of the city of Baltimore. There was only one other home closer to town, and then the Carroll Mansion that was about a half mile out. And the Carrolls are the people that gave the land for the B&O Railroad. So that was it on this side of town. These guys used to apparently host George and Martha Washington when they would be traveling. We are on the Washington Boulevard, which used to be the Columbia Road. And that was essentially I-95 for the East Coast. Colonial days, anyway. So you head out to our right and you end up in Boston, head out to the left. You'll come by the gates of Mount Vernon and end up down in the Carolinas. So kind of everybody who was traveling back and forth to Philadelphia traveled the road in front of our house.
That's great, Linda. If you don't mind, tell us a little bit more, you know, about the property itself, about the rooms and stuff like that.
Okay. We have six rooms total here. Four of them are suites. Every room has a working fireplace in it, and everyone is unique because they were part of the old house. The old house had some Victorian additions to it. And then in 1920, it was joined up to the old shirt and pants factory out back. So it's about 8,000 square feet of home here. On our first floor, of course, we have lots of room for our guests to relax. And that's part of the beauty of this place, is that they can sit here and relax if they're at a convention or if they're a patient across the street at the University of Maryland. it's a place for them to let go of all the hectic life around them. So we have a gorgeous library where we have some nice sipping brandy and things like games if you wanted to play chess or checkers and magazines. We have our front parlor with the fireplace that is a perfect place for the wintertime to sit and relax and have a glass of brandy. And then our dining area, of course, where we always have tea, water, cookies, all kinds of good stuff for the guests to relax. So the rooms themselves, we have two of them actually have big clawfoot tubs in them. And those are our most popular ones for people that want to take their honeymoon night or get their pictures taken. Those are the popular rooms for that.
Excellent. Steve, any questions there before we jump into some of the topics like Airbnb and OTA?
No, Matt, I will refrain because, you know, I can go down preservation alley or whatever, the black hole of preservation talk, and I won't go there today.
Yeah, that's funny. Yes. Steve is very passionate about that stuff. That sounds
well,
good.
And you're going to love it here, Steve, because it's just unbelievable. Johns Hopkins, the third or fifth or whichever he is now, he does a preservation tour several times a year, and he'll make them walk all the way from downtown to come out and see this place because he loves it.
That's great.
It is beautiful.
So actually, while I'm thinking of it, before we get into maybe more general topics, Baltimore, which of course I'm a Baltimorean, my wife and I are, but Baltimore doesn't have a boatload of bed and breakfast. So what's your perspective on that? I know we're going to get into how that might be changing, I guess, but what's it like to be in the bed and breakfast business in Baltimore, especially you've got an outside view because you're not from the area and you've only been doing it for a couple of years. So what's your take on being a bed and breakfast in Baltimore?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was looking at this place, we had a dozen bed and breakfasts that were registered here in the city. We are down to a half a dozen now. In part, a couple of them wanted to retire, but for the most part, the reason we've seen a real dwindling of bed and breakfasts is because you've got a very high tax area, very high cost of, you know, working, you know, business taxes in this town, business filings, that kind of thing are very expensive. And I think a lot of people found it easier, two of them in particular, found it easier to just pretend they weren't real B&Bs and went undercover with Airbnb. However, I just think that Baltimore is one of those cities where you don't think about bed and breakfasts. And therefore, we don't have a lot of them. Or maybe it's the other way around. Because we don't have a lot of them, you don't think about it. If you went somewhere like Lancaster, Pennsylvania, they have 165 of them. You think bed and breakfast when you go to Lancaster. You think bed and breakfast when you go to Vermont. You don't think bed and breakfast when you come to Baltimore, which to me is a real shame because the old buildings that we have here are phenomenal. The architecture in this city is amazing. And I think there's a ton of room to grow that.
Sounds to me like you've got an opportunity to use that marketing background to change things.
Believe me, we are working on it. We are working with the folks that run the convention center, Visit Baltimore. We're looking at things there in terms of how do you promote the independent hotels and inns in the city? How do you grow more of the little guys to play along with the big boys? Because it is important that we have a lot of options for people. And the other thing is with the new Airbnb bill, we are hoping that several of these people that have been commercial operators pretending that they're not will become B&Bs and join us. So we're looking, I've been talking with our council people about, is there a means of looking at the bed and breakfast separately from hotels? Today, if you can sleep five heads in Baltimore, then you are considered a hotel. And therefore, you are required to have all of the same, you know, liability insurance and the sprinkler systems and all the same things that a hotel has to have in terms of, you know, to be registered and licensed. To me, that might be a bit much. You know, I think there's a nice between the Airbnb thing and the hotel thing where a little in like a bed and breakfast would fit. So we've begun that discussion with some of our counselors downtown and are hoping that maybe we can make it easier for people to become B&Bs. Which would be awesome.
That's great. And, you know, that's a nice little segue there. Let's talk a little bit about some of the legislation that's going on in Baltimore right now with regards to Airbnb. There's a lot going on, and I know you've been involved with it kind of on a PR front. So I'd love to hear what's happening with that.
Okay, yeah, I have been involved with it. And we recently had it pass the very last session of the city council this season. We had the vote for Airbnb bill. It was 180189, if anybody wants to check that out. But what it is a means of legislating Airbnb, and not just for Airbnb, but that kind of platform, getting rid of the commercial operators, essentially. When we began the whole thing, one of the early sessions, one of the counselors asked the Airbnb people that were in the room, how many of them had buildings outside of their own private home. And it wasn't until they got up to owning 4 and 5 separate buildings from their own that people started lowering their hands, which means there were people in this city. Well, we had Airbnbs offering the same number of rooms as 4 of the Hiltons, which is our biggest hotel. So that's how many of them were here. So what they were doing, essentially, like you said, was hiding behind the Airbnb platform. So what our legislation says is that a host may list only their primary residence. So you do have to have your homestead to become a new host. You can grandfather in one unit if you've already met the criteria for owning and operating short-term rental prior to December 31st, 2018. So you can grandfather in one unit. And each host has to have a license from the city, and it's a $100 a year fee to that license. But the key thing to this, I think, really beyond the license and the fact that they're going to have the codes and stuff now, is that now we're making the platform responsible as well. So the platforms are the real key here. The fact that the platforms are now going to be responsible to the city of Baltimore. They are no longer allowed to have unlicensed Airbnbs on their site. So they are going to be responsible, and will get, they're subject to fines if they have people in there that are unlicensed. So they are also, they must collect the hotel taxes, and they must keep the records on behalf of their hosts. So these are the two things that they really kind of nail this particular legislation and make it different from a lot of what's happened out there. The Airbnb is now going to have to be stepping up and making sure that their people are licensed. So part of that means that we have to have our license numbers on the website. And that way the people in the council can go through and see who is and who isn't licensed. And the collected taxes are going to help to pay for keeping those people employed.
Wow. Wow. That's interesting. Steve, any comments to that?
Yeah, it is interesting. So, and where is the legislation now? I know it was passed some kind of vote, but then there was something else that needed to happen. Did that fall?
Okay, yeah. On Monday of last week, they made a change to it so that hosts, that people that lived outside the city, could host a property inside the city, you know, as their grandfathered in unit. There was a little bit of ambiguity around that. So they did change that on Monday, and then they needed to get a 75% yay vote in order to run that through the final vote, because they made a change the night of the third reading. But they didn't get that 75%. So what they did, and we think it's because the council people weren't aware that that's what they were voting for. So that meant it had to come back again on Thursday. And on Thursday is when they had the actual vote. So, and it did pass 10 yes, 3 no, and 2 abstain.
Wow. Okay. And how does this compare with trends throughout the country? Because Baltimore's probably not the first and won't be the last to deal with this.
Absolutely.
So how does this compare to maybe some other places that have done it? And in your opinion, do you think this is going to be more of the model, more of kind of the norm as to how other places will handle it?
Yeah, I think a lot of this is based on what was happening in New York and San Francisco and other parts of the country. I know they used a lot of the verbiage similar to what was out in San Francisco. Most of the early rulings did not include the accountability to the platform itself. And that has proven to be a bit of an issue. It allows the platform to continue to pull the wool over the eyes of the local town, right? And they say, oh, we'll give you the money. We'll tell you how much we made. When in, we know that they have not told the truth everywhere. So this is the real difference here, is this platform responsibility thing. We are also unique in that we have the one grandfathered in unit. Most of the places are not allowing grandfathered in units. What we had here was so many people buying and fixing up row homes and then, you know, just holding on to them to lease as short-term rentals. So we had a large number of people that had multiple units. They have 1 year to, at this point, they have 1 year to sell off those units, except for the one that they're going to grandfather in. We learned a lot of lessons, I think, from the other cities, and I think you'll find some of them readdressing what they've got. But I do think this will be more of the trend. I know that some of the big hotels' lawyers have been working on this, and they're trying to, of course, keep consistency, because that way, if it is challenged, there is precedent.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, it really is. Do you all want to shift over and start talking about some OTA strategy stuff? Or Linda, anything else to cover off on in terms of the Airbnb side of things?
The only thing I would say yet on the Airbnb side of things is a lot of the fight was people that own these multiple buildings are now saying, well, you know, you're forcing me to sell, you're forcing me to shut down. These are the people that, because they own multiple buildings, is exactly why they should or could, they have an option of becoming real B&Bs. And then that benefits all of us, right? Then they're following the rules. We're all on an equal platform. Our city is, you know, able to offer more in the way of different accommodations. It would benefit a lot of us if they did. Now the question is there an in-between in terms of what you need to do to become a B&B, is there a way of softening that a little bit so that more of these people are incentivized to become real B&Bs? So I think that's the next discussion here in town.
And actually, so before we get into the OTA thing, we didn't really hit on motivation. I mean, it might seem obvious as to what's, you know, the reason for this type of legislation. And we've had a podcast where we certainly talked about impacts, you know, to a town. It was a, you know, resort type place, South Haven, Michigan. So we did talk about the impact that Airbnb had, and it's worthwhile to hear a little bit of it, of that from your perspective in terms of the neighborhood and that sort of thing. Okay. But also, ultimately, I think there's an equity concern here that, hey, the B&Bs, the real B&Bs, are being, you know, treated as businesses, which you touched on, and whereas these short-term rentals or whatever are not, but people are investing, buying multiple houses, and then using Airbnb, you know, to rent them out on short-term. Tell me how, you know, the main concern about equity and how the deck's stacked against you if you are a B&B versus if you're an Airbnb.
Yeah, the whole Airbnb thing came about because of actually multiple reasons. Equity with the current bed and breakfasts in hotels is part of it. It was with 4 Hilton's worth of rooms in this city, just in my neighborhood, within 2 blocks of me, there are 26 Airbnbs available. That is, it takes away from the hotels and the bed and breakfasts who employ people in the tourism industry and who are required to pay hotel taxes and state taxes to the point of 15.5% in this city, where all of the people that were staying at Airbnbs didn't pay that tax, yet they still wanted to take advantage of all the tourist things that go on in this town in terms of, you know, the conventions and the marketing and all that kind of thing. The reality is, my guests, as guests at a real bed and breakfast or at a hotel, they were actually being penalized. We were penalizing our legitimate tourists 15.5%. not to mention penalizing them for patronizing places that make sure they meet code, that are properly zoned, that are properly protected, and they have the pest control and the liability insurance and the sprinkler systems and all the things that make traveling to Baltimore safe. So you have that equity issue. But past that, you have the whole issue of what's happened to neighborhoods, and particularly here in Baltimore, we have an issue already with affordable housing. It's apparently a family that is working, that is making minimum wage, has to work 100 hours a week in order to afford a one-bedroom apartment in Baltimore. Yeah, these are the people that can't afford cars, so they need to live close to where they work. So by running short-term rentals, you were taking away the available housing that was out there, and you're inflating artificially the prices of housing here in the city of Baltimore. Then there is the whole neighborhood safety thing. We know in cities where Airbnb is very active that there have been upticks in crime that has come from these Airbnbs. So there are issues with human trafficking, with guns and drugs and pornography that can be hidden. But it goes even beyond that. To know who your neighbors are. We have the neighborhood apps that everybody uses. And there is always conversation on there around these Airbnbs. There were people that were staying there last night that, you know, unfortunately, there's profiling, right? People staying there last night that didn't look good, and they were looking in people's cars, and, you know, they're taking our parking places, and we don't know who these people are, and they're partying till all hours on the other side of my three-year-old's wall. You know, that kind of thing makes for a bad neighborhood. And when you've got a city desperately trying to get people to move into it, but you have that kind of talk going on, it's hard to keep people here in the city. So there are many, many layers to this as to why Airbnb has been, the way it has been operating has not been good for the city. And you add to that, what I'm talking about, though, I'm not talking about the mom and pop that have an extra room in their house. I'm talking about the people who have commercial properties that have 2, 3, and 4 buildings, and they're using them solely for the short-term rental. You know, that means they've got 6, 7, 8, 14 bedrooms that they are renting out to people. How is that not an inn or a hotel? I don't understand that. So what we're talking about, 25 in Baltimore, 25% of the B&B or the Airbnb hosts own over 50% of the properties. So clearly, it's not just one-to-one, right? And those are the people we're talking about. We're not talking about the 75% of the owners that just own their house and rent it out as Airbnb is meant to be. We're talking here about the people who are operating real commercial businesses. There's a new building went up downtown, and they were looking for a property manager to manage 150 apartments as Airbnbs in this new building. How is that not a hotel? There's an apartment complex around the corner that has 8 new apartments, and they're renting them as Airbnbs. How is that not a hotel? You know, so that's what we're going after with this bill, with this Airbnb legislation. Does that say what you were looking for?
Well, I don't know if that's what I was looking for, but it certainly answers the question. No, I mean, I didn't have we talked a little bit about it before, but I didn't have a set answer. Sorry, just joking there. But no, it definitely answers the question. It makes a lot of sense. I think the one other thing I think I remember you mentioning was that, I mean, it's the same thing. It's not just taxes, but insurance costs. I mean, you're required, I guess, maybe because of statutes or whatever, that if you're going to be this commercial business, not only are you paying taxes, but you also have to maintain insurance and other things that can,
correct,
that can really jack it up. And we're talking like, you know, in 5 figures, right? It can be $10,000 plus a year for those kinds of insurances, right?
Yeah. So what we have, you're absolutely right. In terms of the how these properties are managed, most of them are run in residentially zoned buildings. And therefore, as residentially zoned buildings, they have residential taxes, they have residential insurance, and they have residential mortgages. So a residential mortgage actually does not allow for short-term rental within your property. If you wanted to do short-term rental in your property, you would need to get a commercial mortgage, which is going to have a different rate and a different payback time period. Also, if you're insuring your property as a residential property, then that residential insurance is going to assume that you are the primary resident there. And they're not going to assume short-term rental usage. So if you had an issue with somebody in a row home, for instance, and they had a bachelor party and somebody, dropped a cigar onto the carpet and began a fire. Well, when that fire begins to go through other row homes as well, and that insurance company finds out that it was actually being rented as a short-term rental, yet it's on residential insurance, now who's going to be responsible now? Who's going to cover that? Who's going to pay for that? So there are lots of things you need to think about in terms of, you know, these Airbnb properties who are really operating under commercial operations, pretending that they're residential homes.
Yeah. And why else would, you mentioned at least one, I think pretty close to you, former bed and breakfast, one underground. I mean, why else would they do that except to avoid all of those costs? I mean, it's understandable. It's just a shame that the inflation has been skewed. So.
Yeah, but those two properties that went underground, they're both on the north side of town. One has 27 rooms, one has 14 rooms. So you're talking tens of thousands of dollars a year in terms of taxes, in terms of, you know, maintaining a fire monitoring, in terms of liability insurance, all the things that you have to run a hotel that you don't have in your private home. So they're saving lots of money, not to mention hassle of trying to make sure you get all of those licenses and all of those taxes and all that paid and up to date.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Linda, appreciate those insights. So if it's okay, why don't we shift over and talk a little bit about your OTA strategy? Tell us about that.
The dreaded OTA. I'll tell you. If we could operate without OTAs, I would. Clearly, in my mind, they are a glorified yellow pages, and they take more as a middleman that has absolutely no skin in the game than our brick and mortar dealers used to take in the high tech industry. And they had to carry inventory and deal with warranties and repair and all that kind of thing. So in my mind, somebody who owns software and does booking and considers themselves a hospitality group is just lying to us all. But the problem is most people don't know that. Most people don't know that they take 18% from us. Most people don't know that they don't have the best rates out there because they spend all of their money trying to convince everybody that they do. So the reality is you have to use them if you need to be constantly moving your, you know, getting new guests, new customers. And I do need that. I need to see new people coming in here all the time. So I do use the OTAs. And in fact, I am listed on Airbnb. I'd be foolish not to. They only take half of what the big boys take. But the way I look at it is they are my marketing. I have to pay more for a new customer. As we know, it's always cheaper to maintain a customer than it is to find a new one. And if I want to find a new one, I need a place where they can find me. So I am on lots of these OTAs, and I do a few of the lists, although most of the lists are not worth much anymore. Bedandbreakfast.com used to be a great list to be on, but now that Expedia owns them, they are just another OTA as well. But like I said, I look at it as my means of getting new customers. But because it is obvious, if you look at my site, most people, when they're looking for a place to stay, will look at 7 to 9 different websites before they'll decide where they want to go. So usually if they find me on one of these other sites, they will come and find me on my own site as well. And when they do, they'll find that I'm cheaper. So I do get a lot of people that come in through there. And, you know, Google helps us with that, of course, but they also are in bed with Expedia. So there's a double-edged sword there. But so the way I look at it, once they're here, I let them know, I tell every guest before they go that I'm always cheaper than those online guys. And I also do a loyalty program. If somebody comes back to me a second time, they get an additional money off. And what I do essentially is I split the money that I pay to the online travel agents with my guests when they come back. So we both win. And that seems to be working. I noticed that last year, I was over 30% of my bookings came through the online travel agents. And the second half of this year, that has dropped off to 25%. And I think it's because people are realizing that booking direct does make more sense. And they're checking the direct hotel and B&B sites.
Yeah. And then do you do any like post-stay marketing in order to kind of stay in touch with the people that have stayed with you and reinforce that? Are you doing anything like that? Or is it just a matter of letting them know, you know, when they're here, letting them know if you come back, you know, you can get a discount or what?
You know, that's always the popular one. But I make sure that I interact with my guests here and we're friends by the time they leave. So, yeah, I do have often I send thank you notes to all of them when they leave. And often we get follow-up conversations with them and they'll send me photos or post photos. I ask them all to rank, do some ratings for me on the various websites. So I try to keep that going. And through Facebook, I let them know what's going on around here, what things are worth coming back for, if we've got any special rates going for winter or anything like that. So I do stay in touch with a lot of them. I'm happy to say that I've got a good number of them on my Facebook that follow me on Facebook. So those that live in the area, we tend to become friends. They feel very comfortable coming back here. And every time they do, I say, welcome home. So for me, I love the fact that they usually say we're going to Linda's rather than we're going to Rachel's Dowry. So that makes it feel a little more like family. But it's been kind of fun because the word of mouth is really the marketing that's been working for me the best. And it's because I have people that come for baseball, you tend to get a lot of the baseball and the convention people return year after year. So that's been kind of fun to watch. I've gained some really good friends through that. I had a couple of instances. Last week, I got an email from a woman in North Carolina who said she met somebody else down there and they were talking that they had both been to Baltimore and both of them had stayed at Rachel's. So there was a little bit of camaraderie there. But I had another couple two couples that were down for the Blue Jays game. And they were laughing the first morning at breakfast after the game because they had run into each other the night before and the one recognized the other one's voice from local radio. And they got talking and found out they live 5 blocks away from each other. Well, I then got another email from the radio gentleman who said that he and his buddy went to another friend's bar after playing bridge to discuss their shortcomings, he said. And there was somebody, a couple at the bar there from a town 20 minutes away, talking about having just been down to a Blue Jays game. And the bartender introduced them and he said, so where did you stay? And they said, this little cute little B&B right next to the stadium. And he said, Rachel's? And they screamed, yes! So when we get those kinds of conversations going among people, it definitely is a means of solidifying the family, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that is cool. Nice. That's awesome. You know, Linda, we've covered off on a lot of things today, and I'll throw this out to both of you. Is there anything else we all collectively would like to add here before we close it out? Anything we may have missed?
Not that I can think of. If you guys think of anything, please feel free to let me know. And when I get the cookie business going, I'll let you know.
That would be great. That'd be great. Steve, any last questions for Linda?
No, I think we covered most of what I think was worthwhile covering. So, no, that was great.
Oh, thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Perfect. Well, we appreciate your time, Linda. And I'll take us out here with our standard outro. And for all of our listeners, you just heard an exclusive Frictionless Innkeeper podcast interview with Linda Smith, the owner and operator of Rachel's Dowry Bed and Breakfast. And as you heard, Linda was kind enough to share her overall innkeeper story as well as discuss her OTA strategy. She also provided us with an update regarding the new legislation happening in Baltimore with regards to Airbnb. And we really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Frictionless Innkeeper podcast brought to you by the Frictionless Guest app. And once again, if you wish to learn more, please visit frictionlessguest.com. That's frictionlessguest.com. And Steve and Linda, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.